All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Crypto 101 podcast. I am joined, as always, by my notorious compadre, Mr. Aaron Malone. Pizza Mind, how you doing over there, buddy? Staying warm this winter, I sure hope.
Absolutely not. It's been freezing cold here in Texas. We got some snow on New Year's, but that's not stopping us. The Bitcoin freeze. The Bitcoin freeze at 46K is not stopping us, as other coins are finally decoupling from their BTC shackles.
Yeah, it seems like we're getting a pretty nice run here. Markets. Getting pretty nice run here in the altcoin markets. Off to a really strong start. And we're joined actually by, you know, the CEO of a really interesting DeFi project called FutureSwap, Derek Ulia. Welcome to the Crypto 101 podcast.
Guys, thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're going to dive into all sorts of stuff, you know, derivatives, trading, open interest, options, perpetual swaps, all sorts of stuff. But first, Derek, let's just get quickly acquainted. You know, what's your background?
My background is mostly in software engineering, just building cool stuff, building, it was really early on building iPhone apps and sort of saw the gamification of the App Store, and was really interesting to see how when new markets are opened up, sort of what changes and innovations those bring. And I think, you know, crypto has a lot of parallels to what happened with the iPhone, especially in terms of what Ethereum did in terms of like creating an app store. There's a lot of parallels there of just opening it up to developers and innovation and new things that could be created. So yeah, backgrounds in building stuff.
Yeah, that's epic. Yeah, it was funny because right before we hit record, you asked us a question, and you said, are you guys like maximalists on any certain chains, Ethereum maximalists, Bitcoin maxi? And, you know, Aaron and I both, you know, shook our head. Nah, we like all the altcoins and different, you know, we think there's, you know, lots of value to be found. And you kind of agreed and you said, yeah, you're a decentralization maxi. So what does that kind of mean? And in context of, you know, maybe Ethereum, but what is a decentralization maxi?
Yeah, I think on a high level, it's, you know, you want to go to where things are least centralized, because I think when you start to get centralization, you get sort of funky behavior that we're all trying to sort of pull away from. I mean, the whole notion of Bitcoin is to get away from that behavior and to
malicious open up behavior.
And malicious behavior, or just like, you know, humans in the loop with too much power, too much control, sort of muck up things eventually. And so it should be a more decentralized network where sort of there's composability, there's permissionlessness, and Ethereum really embodies this pretty well and pushed this early on. If you look at, you know, something like Uniswap, what a great example of, you know, something that's decentralized, at least very early on, where people could sort of build on top of Uniswap. You could create your own markets. You know, one of the reasons why Uniswap was so popular is because they had this notion of you can create your own pair and create an exchange. Before, to get listed on these centralized exchanges, like, it cost, you know, $1 million to list your ICO token over there. It was expensive. And then going from $1 million to, you know, an Ethereum transaction, which at the time was probably like $10 to create a new pool.
Those were the days.
That's a huge shift.
Well, I think we'll return to those days, hopefully, of, you know, all these complex transactions with kind of many sorts of transactions baked into one that are now, you know, they cost you a couple hundred to maybe even $1,000, you know, minting NFTs and all that kind of stuff. But I think that as L2s, all right, layer twos and optimism and everything kind of comes online, and maybe the merge goes well, and hopefully those Ethereum gas fees kind of come down soon. But I think that's a big problem that a lot of, you know, people are having, you know, a lot of our listeners, at least, you know, express a lot of frustration with that. And you're a guy who's building on Ethereum, you know, FutureSwap is an application built on Ethereum. So what do you kind of have, you know, what's your hot take on Ethereum gas fees and how do you guys kind of grapple with that?
The rent is high in Ethereum land. High rent.
It's Manhattan.
It's the Manhattan of crypto. It's very expensive to, you know, to kind of get more users, to build really cool stuff. It's very limited. You don't get a lot of space to do cool stuff. You know, there's other places where you can go and sort of explore, but a lot of the network effects right now are on Ethereum. You know, it is essentially the Manhattan of crypto right now.
I really love that analogy of that, of Ethereum being the Manhattan, because that's where the quality projects are going to live. That's where the quality users are going to be, versus something like a Binance Smart Chain, where all of a sudden you've got all kinds of craziness going on, you know, crime, like, and quite literally in a sense sometimes, with all the rug pulls and shit coins and madness that goes on over there. But if you're going to build something on Ethereum, you're really going to be catering to a completely different audience than Binance Smart Chain or even Polygon. So how have you had to pivot your product once this, you know, sky rise of gas prices started emerging?
Well, we were pretty lucky early on. You know, we started FutureSwap in 2020 on 420. Surprisingly. you know, even then it was pretty high, but it wasn't anything compared to what it was, what it is right now. And so we were able to get quite a bit of traction in the early days. We were the first to launch perpetuals on Ethereum. I think any decentralized perpetuals, actually, we were the first. So it was kind of some good insight into seeing what that looks like on L1. But what we quickly realized is that the resources that we needed were not available to us in this place. You know, we just demanded a faster pace of things. We required sort of very fast price updates, and it was hard. It's very expensive to do that at scale. And that was on one market. You know, the idea was to launch on many markets. So this was going to be a huge hurdle. And so we had to sort of slow things down and think about how do we rebuild this in a way that actually scales. So when we relaunched on Ethereum, we relaunched it in a way that it had these scaling properties. With that led us to, you know, billions of dollars in volume, which was pretty amazing. We were able to do things our competitors couldn't do. But even then, you know, the rest of the ecosystem started heating up, and, you know, DeFi summer was there, and it was just too hot to be in there. It was just the gas prices there. People were doing like $2,000 transaction fees just to run a trade. And it was like, that was incredible and unsustainable. Like, it's hard to grow a user base with that kind of barrier. So started looking at other places. And, you know, the Arbitrum team, we had been in talks with for a while, and it looked like that they were going to emerge as one of the first scaling solutions that could sort of launch on and see how things went over there. I think, you know, there's an incredible amount of challenges beyond just building a technical product, but there's also product challenges in terms of usage and user bases and network effects. I mean, we talked about Manhattan earlier, sort of Arbitrum and these other layer twos and L1s, they're essentially building new cities, right? And sort of when you build a new city, it's really exciting. It is the Wild West. You look at Binance Smart Chain, like that is the Wild West in so many ways, right? It's so far away from what we had on Ethereum, right? That was like really, you know.
Yeah, Binance Smart Chain is kind of like a little casino crazy area.
I mean, I didn't say that, but but it's definitely a different value set than the Ethereum value set, I think. Where Ethereum, it's sort of like you're there to build your reputation. Where in Binance, it's sort of like, how exciting can this get, right?
Yeah. It reminds me of like a flea market. where you might find a good value or you might find a broken VCR that never works once you get home and plug it in. You just never really know what you're going to get over there. But Ethereum has the largest group of open source developers in the world. So they're going to figure this stuff out. And you mentioned Arbitrum. There's other things like Scale Labs. They're working on something. Optimism is another thing. And you mentioned these are their own cities. Can we sort of draw like a word picture for the audience what transacting on one of these things is actually like? Is it the same user experience and then it just eventually gets settled on Ethereum? Is it similar to the Lightning Network where you have these open state channels that don't achieve final settlement until later? How does Optimism and Arbitrum and all these other things actually work?
I mean, they're all pretty similar at the end of the day, right? In the sense that, you know, maybe one syncs up with Ethereum, maybe another one doesn't. You know, it's depending on the audience that they're catering to, what the audience cares about, right? If Arbitrum tomorrow said, you know what, we're not going to sync with Ethereum, we're going to be our own L1, how would that impact them? Or Optimism says that, or, you know, you look at Avalanche, you look at Binance Smart Chain doesn't sync with Ethereum, right? They've sort of cut ties and they're independent. And there's benefits to that, right? There's benefits to sort of being a connected city, a Brooklyn, right? So, you know, I think at the end of the day, they look pretty similar. And what they need to have is like, what is the unique feature that they bring for their community? I think that's what these chains need to focus on, because, you know, they're all working really hard on making scaling possible. Everyone's working on that. And I think most of them will get it in their own way. And there will be trade-offs. And it'll be a while until we see what trade-offs were valuable and who made the right decision, who made the wrong decision. But for now, we're in a state of sort of like, okay, they're scalable. Now, which one do you decide to go on?
It's interesting. Yeah, we brought Ed Felton from Off-Chain Labs who was building the Arbitrum network, and we brought him on like 2 years ago. And it's crazy that just this year, finally, you know, it started to get a lot of liquidity and a lot of bridging over to it. So it's really exciting to see. But let's kind of zoom back into FutureSwap in particular. What was the particular need that you saw in the market that you said, all right, FutureSwap is going to go fill that need?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, people want to have leverage on a lot of these on these assets. And so the professional traders essentially say, hey, I want more exposure. I want to de-risk in some ways. I want to hedge. And, you know, we said, let's offer this as a service to these groups. That was, you know, the basis. And that has now grown into, you know, really understanding where this market is going. I think, you know, there's some groups that have done a great job. And I think the market is certainly shifting in many ways in terms of what users want and what users care about. And we've sort of, you know, we've built four different versions of FutureSwap, three of them this year. So we've been pretty busy at iterating and user testing and trying to understand, you know, what's really valuable. Because I think anyone, you know, it's pretty easy to clone what's already existing. It's hard to create something that's a huge shift in the direction. And so if you look at something like, you know, DYDX, you know, it seems like their whole thing is we just want to be like FTX, but like non-custodial, mm-hmm. not even decentralized, but just like non-custodial.
Interesting.
And there's a particular niche of users who care about that. And then there's other users who are just like, you know, it's not really a decentralized product. It's sort of a very centralized product. And there's trade-offs there, right? It's not that I'm knocking it. It's like, you know, for them to achieve sort of their value for their audience, they have to scale at a certain rate. And right now, most of the products are not capable of doing that. So they have to sort of centralize.
So after peaking at $68,000 in mid-November, Bitcoin has dropped by roughly 40%. So no one said flying the DeFi flag was going to be easy. But what if I told you that your portfolio might be overweight in Bitcoin? In fact, you might also want to consider diversifying into other alternative assets, perhaps like blue chip art. In some cases, actually, paintings have seen appreciation similar to crypto over the long term. For instance, a Picasso painting recently sold for $103 million at an auction, and that's a 1,400% increase from its original price at auction. And now there's a new platform that lets you invest in paintings like that without needing to be a gazillionaire. And over 310,000 investors have signed up. And just the other day, they had a $7.4 million Banksy painting that sold out in under 3 hours. Now, I've partnered with this platform and got you all priority access to their newest paintings. And so all you got to do is log on to masterworks.io/crypto101. Again, that's masterworks.io/crypto101. Again, masterworks.io/crypto101. And you can check out all the good stuff they got on their platform. So I want you guys as well to see the important disclosures that are at masterworks.io/disclaimer. And we're also going to link to those in the show notes. For a guy who's built and deployed a decentralized exchange, derivatives exchange, what is the go-to-market strategy for getting liquidity and getting users on the platform? Because, you know, a platform is only so good insofar as there's a lot of liquidity and a lot of active trading. And so did you have to subsidize early usage through liquidity mining programs or kind of what was going on?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, like, people want to trade on things that are interesting and that are that there's demand for, right? And so it wasn't too hard to open something up and have people use it, but now the marketplace is more competitive, and so it's sort of the landscape has changed. But early on, yes, we were one of the first to incentivize trading. I think we were probably the first group to really incentivize liquidity mining, trade mining,
What were some of the key takeaways from that? Just looking back, a year from, past when that has happened, what's kind of the main takeaways? Was it a net positive? And what would you have changed about the process? And maybe there's some projects that are helping bootstrap liquidity for new projects now that you're looking into.
Yeah, I mean, there's an incredible amount of liquidity. I mean, look at the rise of these stable projects. I mean, that seems to be the current trend, which is the market is sort of worried about what's going on right now, and people are feeling very conservative. So let's move over to stable and then just focus on high yield stable tokens.
Yep.
That's what we see, right?
Mm-hmm. That's crazy.
Look at Fei, look at Magic Internet Money, look at Frax, look at Terra. Mm-hmm. If you look at look at Curve.
Convex wars that are going on.
Like this is sort of the most interesting thing that's happening right now, and something that we're looking at very closely. I didn't mention Olympus DAO and all the derivatives.
Tokamak.
Tokamak is sort of in a different category in terms of that they're more strategy based, but I think in terms of stable projects, you have an incredible amount of stable popping up to sort of have dominance. And I think this is creating a really interesting inflection point where you're instable, you're earning yield, you're conservative, but you're missing out on this potential growth of kind of these projects that are emerging that are going to be very exciting. I think there's some interesting questions along those lines.
When you were building FutureSwap and analyzing everything else on the market, what did you decide to build that was different? You said, you know, maybe I don't like the way Binance is doing this or Bybit is doing that. You know, when you're building a decentralized derivatives exchange, what are the unique features that come with being decentralized and building your own stuff? What makes FutureSwap really different?
Yeah, I mean, right now, you know, FutureSwap is fully decentralized. We hook into Uniswap v3, but we have a large update coming, which enables essentially any AMM to be integrated with FutureSwap, which means that we can tap into any liquidity pool that we want. So that's really exciting. And so
sounds big.
Yeah, that's pretty big.
Yeah, I think you're downplaying this a little bit. What is that going to do in terms of like multiples to like liquidity? Like, have you guys kind of done the projections of how much, you know, more capital efficient things are going to be? Or
I mean, just to put it, there's $50 billion in AMMs right now.
$50 billion, okay.
And
between like Uniswap, SushiSwap, Balancer, Curve, like all those things, right?
I mean, you could even probably minus Balancer. I'm not sure if you add in Curve what that does, but the numbers around there. And we're talking okay. Multi-chain EVM chains.
Got it.
Okay. If you include non-EVM, it's even larger.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of liquidity in AMMs, and it, you know, no one's really tapping into those. And so we're really excited to be able to tap into the liquidity of so many of these AMMs that users basically want to have exposure on these different pools that these different AMMs specialize in. And so we'll be sort of the first to market on that. So that's something that we've been working on that we'll be announcing soon. It's very exciting.
That's fantastic. Have you seen some pretty good uptake in usage of FutureSwap? Would you say like it's more of something that like hedge funds have really spent a lot of time, you know, using, or is it more retail? And have you guys even approached, you know, other funds to get them on and stuff?
You know, we've been focusing on building a product that brings a lot of value to our users. And one thing that we realize is, you know, it's really important that FutureSwap, you know, goes to where the liquidity is. I think these chains are all doing a really great job of building up their liquidity. And, you know, for FutureSwap to be really useful, liquidity is a core component. So I think right now we're in an age where there's not a lot of liquidity where we currently are, but I think that's growing. But we plan on, you know, so tapping into more liquidity in places that, you know, we think is beneficial for our community. So I think you're going to see a lot of change over the next couple of months and a lot of really interesting things. But on the whole, I think, you know, FutureSwap, this latest version V4, has been battle tested for the last couple of months to show that we can basically create perpetuals on top of any AMM. And I think few people understand that. And that's without us having to market make, that's without us having to do a lot of stuff. So it's very organic. So, you know, this current exchange that we're on is sort of a test bed for, hey, does this actually work at scale? And so far, everything says yes. And the next step is just to plug into more.
Nice.
Yeah.
Do you, you know, personally trade? I'm curious, like, you know, you built a pretty fancy trading platform. Are you yourself a pretty active trader?
You know, in the past, I had more time available to trade. but I think most of my time is spent building and working with my team on creating product.
I'm curious, just your kind of take here on the market. I know you kind of sensed the market was maybe shifting a little bit more to some yield generating opportunities, maybe risking off. I'm just curious about any take for the first quarter here, first two quarters of the year. Where do you think kind of the market's going? Of course, nothing you say should ever be construed as financial advice, not trading advice, but just trying to get into the mind here of Derek Alia.
Yeah, I think, I think you're going to see more rise of stable usage. I think, people are going after high yield with their stable. And I think you're going to see more protocols catering to this. And I think ultimately you're going to have derivatives around these stable projects that have their own token that people want exposure on, because it's basically going to be, like we said, the convex wars, right? People are going to be trading. There's going to be winners and there's going to be losers. And that's going to be very interesting. In terms of being able to hedge, your strategy.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I think there's going to be a big trend of these, liquid staking derivatives and all that kind of stuff that seems to be popping up. There's definitely going to be quite a large market for all sorts of, new digital assets. Derek, before we let you go, we got a couple quick questions that we typically, ask, every guest that comes on the show. One question is just out of all the other teams that are building, out there right now, could you give one shout out to one team that's really, really impressed you, or maybe it's one developer that you're just like, kind of a fanboy of or anything like that. Always curious about this question.
I mean, I think, Joey from Faye has been doing, a really fantastic job of just being bold. He recently did the Rari, sorry, not Rari.
The Tribe token.
The Tribe token.
And they merged. They had a little merger with Rari Capital, didn't they?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, so it was Rari. And they basically merged. A lot of people were against this. He was for it. And obviously he was for it. And I think that's hard to do. And ultimately, I think what we're going to see is more of these mergers. This is what I predict as a trend, and it makes sense. And I think this was the first of many, and you're going to basically see, people being pretty bold with the, TVL they had. They basically are going to do something with it, especially the protocol owned community, the protocol owned, what is it? Lock value.
Yeah. Sorry, yeah. This. Protocol owned liquidity and
protocol owned liquidity
value.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of buzzwords.
A lot of buzzwords. Sorry. I guess we can just repeat that. So I think there's going to be a lot of really interesting, stuff with protocol owned liquidity and this whole notion of DeFi 2.0. Essentially these groups have to make bold moves to really make a difference, because it's really heating up, especially for the stable token. So I think there's going to be a lot of action there. I would do a shout out to Joey just for being bold and doing some interesting.
Can I actually ask you a little bit about just high level that Rari Tribe merger? What was the high level goal that they accomplished there? And that's kind of repeatable for other tokens. Like, what was the problem they were trying to really solve there that they did?
I think ultimately, Fae is a stable token, and if they can essentially plug into more use cases, that's good for Fae. Rari was one of those groups with these fuse pools, right? It had a lot of usage. It was exciting. There's a lot of collaboration that they could do. And also you've got this large community, and you've got a great engineering team, right? That's also bold in terms of just being able to iterate quickly. Sometimes things break, that happens. I think the goal is sort of like, how can we sort of take the funds that we have and do something with them? And one way to do something is to acquire communities and teams and protocols that can provide a lot of value to your protocol. And, you know, adding more yield to Fei is sort of one of their goals, and that's what they did.
Interesting. Before we let you go, Derek, there's going to be a lot of people that are listening to this podcast that are going to go try futures trading for the first time after listening. Can you send us off with some words of wisdom and perhaps some words of warning for our first-time futures traders?
Yeah, so I would say, you know, it's an extremely powerful tool, and it should be used with caution. But at the end of the day, you should understand sort of what FutureSwap does and what FutureSwap is. And if you can kind of use that to your advantage to understand the market and take on directional position, that's, you know, that can be extremely beneficial. I would say if you look at, you know, who's making a lot of the money in crypto, oftentimes you have these traders who are just, you know, leveraged up. You know, it's a double-edged sword. It can also be very dangerous and should be used with caution. You know, use low leverage when you can. Obviously, people get really passionate and want to go big. But, you know, I think use a product that's safe. And, you know, our whole thing with FutureSwap is we want to make sure we can take you to the most interesting places in the safest way possible. And that's sort of what we're committed to. And you're going to see a lot more interesting places with FutureSwap and sort of where we're going. And, you know, just come join the community, be part of it. And yeah, should be a lot of fun.
Cool. All right. Well, I love it. Those are some good closing notes. And without further ado, Derek, we'll let you go. Get back to building the future of finance. And me and Aaron, we'll sign off for now. Everybody who's at home, thanks for listening. We'll see you soon.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.